Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Good morning and welcome. I'm Harry Miller.
And good morning. I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm. We are here to chat with you every Saturday morning, some combination of Jane Marie, myself, Deb Verney, and Dave Kapikian. And welcome. We talk about estate planning, asset protection planning, advanced directives, estate administration, Medicaid planning, accessing home care through the Medicaid system. Any of those things that you would like to discuss with us or anything else that happens to be on your mind, we would welcome your calls here at Magic 590. The number in the studio is 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Outside the local calling area, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-WROW-590. So, Jane Marie, I guess we're getting ready for a big snowstorm this afternoon, huh?
Yes, it looks like the Berkshires are going to get a foot or more, so.
Your stomping ground.
That's right.
Jane Marie lives in Western Massachusetts. She commutes over here every day.
So a foot of snow is really nothing.
I don't know. How much are we supposed to get around here, Ben? Do they have any accumulation forecasts? Or
3 to 6 for us capital region.
Oh, we can handle that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
You're used to it anyway, right?
I'm used to a foot.
Okay. Super. We have a series of seminars coming up next week, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the snow will all be cleared away by Tuesday, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure. So these are our basic estate and Medicaid planning seminars where we're going to introduce you to ourselves. We're going to talk about some, you know, basic concepts of wills and trusts, healthcare proxies, powers of attorney, ways to protect your assets and things. So on January 21st, which is Tuesday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we'll be in Clifton Park at the Hampton Inn. Wednesday, the 22nd, we'll be at 2 o'clock also, the Courtyard by Marriott on Washington Avenue. It's right across from the main entrance to the State Unit, SUNY Albany. On Thursday, there are two seminars, one at 10 in the morning, Courtyard by Marriott on Wolf Road. And that's the new one, isn't it?
That's a new one, yes.
It's mm-hmm. the new hotel on the mm-hmm. Times Union end of mm-hmm. Wolf Road. And then later on the same afternoon, we will be in Schenectady, again at the Courtyard by Marriott.
Another new one.
Mohawk Harbor, yeah. Mm-hmm. New hotel, yeah.
And you can go gambling right after that.
It's near the casino.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Debbie Verney's doing that one. Anyway, we got a caller waiting, so we don't want to keep Kathy waiting anymore. Kathy, good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, what would you like to talk about this morning?
I have a husband who is probably going to have to go on community Medicaid
mm-hmm.
because his long-term care insurance only covers him at home for about 10 hours.
Now, I see. Mm-hmm.
But my question was, if we apply for community Medicaid, his only income is about $860 Social Security. That's it.
Yes.
I'm still working. And I have an IRA, which I can put in payout status.
Right. Okay.
My question is, does any of my income have to go towards his care?
It'll be counted, your income, if we did spousal budgeting, right, Jane Marie?
Yes.
The income allowance between the two of you would be about $3,200 a month.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, that would be his income and also your mm-hmm. your income added together.
Right, but once you sign up with an MLTC, which is how you get community Medicaid, and I know that's a little
it's a managed
technical.
Long-term care
right.
company.
They will then just look at his income, and then they will disregard your income.
Even including my IRA if it's in payout status?
Yeah.
Right, if your IRA is in payout status, then they'll exempt that.
Okay. Well, they'll exempt the IRA, but the mm-hmm. distributions right. you have to take out will be treated as part of your income.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my income.
Yes, that's your income.
I'm not taking anything from his income.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So they would only count his income.
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And my only other question was that a quick one on the, if you have like that 128, which is the maximum you can keep mm-hmm. asset-wise,
mm-hmm.
is that a case of But let's say you have $200,000, you can keep $100,000, not $128,000. Is that the way that works?
It's half of the. I think it's half of the.
Right.
Half the resources up to a maximum of 128, but
right. So it's not like if you have 200,000, you can keep 128.
No, but if you did have for community Medicaid,
yeah.
If you had excess resources or assets, you could transfer them to a trust that you could create. And unlike nursing home applications, the 5-year look back penalty does not apply for home care.
Right, but the only thing that scares me on that is what if he had to go to a nursing home and he couldn't?
Well, then if you transfer, obviously, then the assets
then
would come back into play.
A problem, yeah.
But if you're, I don't know, but, if at 70 and a half, let's say you had $100,000 in an IRA, at 70 and a half, the annual distribution would be a little less than $4,000, okay? Now, if you're, I'm assuming you're less than 70 and a half because you're not taking anything out.
Yeah, and I'm only 65.
So it's going to be even less than that because your life expectancy is longer at 65 than it is at 70 and a half. Or now you can let it ride till you're 72, okay, under the new law that went into effect on January 1st. You don't have to actually start taking distributions out until you're 72. You can, and since you're over 59 and a half, there'd be no penalty for taking it out at your age, so.
But wouldn't that IRA become an asset if it's not payout status?
If it's not in periodic distribution status, yes. But once you put it in distribution status, if you're taking $4,000 a year out, they disregard the $100,000. It's not part of your assets, and you can still have the other $100 or $128 on top of the IRA.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
If you need any help, if you need help with that, let us know. We do. I don't know. What do we do? 50 or 60 community applications last year?
Oh, easily, if not
more. Or more,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all there, right. Yeah, good.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening. Mm-hmm. I mean, she brings up a really important point, and that is the availability of community home care services through the Medicaid system. I have them in place for my mother-in-law, my wife's mother. She is currently receiving, I think, 30, she's approved for 28 or 30 hours a week of home care. So my wife has found a woman, actually just found another person because the current person who was taking care of her had some family medical emergencies, and so we had to supplement the time. So there's a woman now who comes in every day, Monday to Friday, for 4 hours a day, like 10:30 to 2:30, and Monday to Friday, and then we have somebody else who covers on the weekends, and it's allowing my wife's mom to stay in her apartment because, frankly, without that kind of aid on a regular basis, she probably wouldn't be able to do that.
Right. So, and you can become eligible for that, as you said, even if you haven't planned in advance. And if you haven't made a trust 5 years in advance, you can do that now. And
it doesn't matter. She had some excess resources, so we took her excess resources and moved them into a trust. She had a trust we set up years ago when her husband was still alive. But you can move all the assets into the trust in January, and you can apply for the home care in February. You don't have to wait five years. That's a huge advantage to the community Medicaid program because we can help keep people out of a nursing home a lot longer. And in the case of my mother-in-law, for instance, she has excess income. She has excess income because the income level for a widow is like $900 a month.
Right.
So you couldn't live in a house or an apartment on $900 a month. So her excess income every month goes into what's called a not-for-profit pooled supplemental needs trust. That's a mouthful.
Whoa. Right.
But it's a vehicle. There are a number of nonprofit organizations who manage these things for people who are receiving home care. So every month you send a check to the nonprofit organization for the excess income, and they put it in a trust account. She's got her name and an account number. And then my wife tells her which of my mother-in-law's bills to pay out of that excess income. They pay her rent. They pay her health insurance premium. They pay her cell phone bill. They pay her cable TV bill, her national grid. So all of her bills get paid with this excess income. And it's all coordinated through the Medicaid system. I mean, we're not hiding the income. Mm-hmm. Medicaid knows we're doing this, and it's perfectly legitimate to do that and shelter your excess income. So you have the best of both worlds. You can retain your assets, protect most of your income, and get these home care services.
And still get the services paid for at home. Right. And it keeps you in the community longer, which is not only what most people would prefer to do, it's cheaper. Cheaper to keep people in the community rather than going to a nursing home. So it's really a benefit for everyone. It also provides employment for people in the community.
It does. I mean, they're paying, the MLTC that we're in, I think the person who's taking care of my mother, I think she gets paid $14.75 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's more than minimum wage. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you know, if you go to these agencies, they'll charge you $25 an hour, but probably only paying the person the minimum same. Wage, which is, what is that now, about $11.80 an hour? I think just went up a little bit in New York State, but 476-5900. If you have a question here, you want to talk about community Medicaid or anything else, 476-5900. Don't forget to push the 518. And Jane Marie and I will be happy to talk to you.
There was an interesting estate we were going.
Yeah, we sometimes we talk about estates of the rich and famous. And,
that's right. And there's one that happened recently.
Well, of course, and you all know this estate, and there was an article in the paper this week about it. Mary Lou Whitney's will was probated in Boston Spa, which is the county seat of Saratoga County this week. And
because when you probate the will, it's public.
It's a public document.
So everyone can know what was in her will.
And we do. And so, I mean, my first question is why?
Right. Why would you?
Why didn't Mary Lou have a trust? Trusts are private. And none of this stuff would be public. The wills we do that pour over into a trust simply say, when I die, take all my assets that might pass through this will, pour them into my trust, and dispose of them the way the trust says. But the will doesn't say what the trust says. It just refers to it.
Right, and the trust is private, and no one can read that.
And it doesn't have to be filed with the county surrogates court. So, way down, and particularly, I mean, she has an estate plan that, to me, raises some questions. I don't know. I'm sure there are legitimate good reasons to doing all this stuff. Far be it for me to criticize. But, for instance, of her entire estate, she left about $17 million to her children, okay? Which sounds like a lot to us, but it's not a big chunk of change as far as Mary Lou is concerned.
Not for her estate, that's right.
So she had five kids. She had five kids. Her first husband was a guy named Frank Hosford. He was the heir to the John Deere tractor fortune, okay? She married well. Mary Lou married well. She was from Kansas City, Missouri. You know, she's a Midwest, you know, corn-fed girl. She was an actress. She was a TV actress for a while, I think, in the 40s and 50s and... Anyway, she and Frank had four kids, and then they got divorced, and then she married Sonny Whitney, and they had one daughter, I believe. Okay, and then, because Sonny died in the 90s. So the children are treated completely unequally in her will by a dramatic. So there may be very legitimate reasons why one got more than the other, but...
one got a lot less than the others, right?
Yeah, I mean... The daughter who was Sonny Whitney's daughter got like $10 million. Okay, the next three kids, the Hosford kids, one of them got $5 million, the other two got $1 million each, and then there's a fourth daughter who lives in England who apparently only got $200,000. Whoa, what she did? But now it could very well be. I'm not saying anything, but that's a huge divergence between five children to give one of them $10 million and one of them $200,000. That's interesting. There may have been perfectly legitimate reasons. She may have had other gifts and things over the course of her life that equalizes everything. She also had a provision in her will of what we call an interorum clause. Okay, which fill everybody in on that.
No contest clause. So those clauses say that if anyone contests my will, then they don't get anything.
That's right.
They only
this is
get
a big club we use, particularly when we're treating people unequally.
Yes.
And these are not all states allow the inclusion of an interorum clause. It's a Latin phrase means to put someone in fear or in terror of some awful thing that's going to happen. Well, the awful thing that's going to happen is you're not going to get any money from mama.
That's
so
right.
If you challenge my will, you don't get a nickel.
Well, it must have worked because all of her children consented.
They did. They all signed waivers.
Of the will. That's right. And
Guess who the big winner in this contest was?
It's her.
Isn't it her husband now?
John Hendrickson. Mm-hmm. After the $17 million, everything goes to Hendrickson.
Including the horses and everything, right?
Well, there's a Katy Hill estate in Saratoga, which is not only a gorgeous house, it's on 132 acres of land in Saratoga. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's a big estate. There's a horse farm in Kentucky, and I'm pretty sure she had a place down in Palm Beach, Florida, okay? And then God knows how much other money there was besides
that. That's right.
It all goes to John. Now, they were married for 20 years, but, you know, he's her third husband. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when they married 20 years ago, he may be very wealthy, too. I don't know. He was from Alaska, I believe. Originally, or he was living in Alaska at the time. I don't know if he's from there. But obviously, they didn't have a prenuptial agreement.
Mm-hmm. No, and he made out pretty well in this, as far as we can tell. Now, what we don't know is if there are other trusts in addition to the will.
There may be dozens of trusts that were set up for children and grandchildren. None of this we know about. And so it's very likely there could be trusts that go to charities and things like that. But the will itself, of course, doesn't leave anything other than to those people. So, you know, kind of a fascinating will. It brings up a lot of questions and things, but, you know.
Well, what's also interesting is because she has property in Kentucky and property here, that they have to, I think in the article they said they had to start a probate in Kentucky to take care of that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It could be up here. Maybe this is just an ancillary probate proceeding. But again, it raises the question of why wasn't the real estate assets put into a trust? Because you could have avoided multiple probate proceedings. When you own property in more than one state, even though you live in New York, if you have a condominium in Florida or any place else, doesn't matter, when you die, unless it's in joint names with somebody, the will has to be probated not only in New York in order to dispose of your house here, then you have to take it down to Florida. The same will has to then be probated in Florida. Otherwise, you can't transfer the condominium in Florida. So that's called ancillary probate. It's an additional probate proceeding.
Right.
And these things aren't cheap.
So you can get around that by putting your out-of-state property into your New York trust. So
yeah,
a lot of our clients have two homes.
If you have three houses, you don't need three trusts. You can put all three houses in one trust.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it can be your New York trust for your Florida property, and that still works.
We do it all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing people have is, which becomes a serious problem when they pass away, is a lot of people have still have timeshares.
Oh, yes. Those
God,
are always
remember
a
those things?
Yes.
Wow. They are a pain to get rid of when somebody passes away. They're deeded timeshares mostly. Mm-hmm. Just like a house, you got to probate the will, and maybe the timeshare isn't worth much of anything. Russell, down in Kingston. Hello, Russell. How are you?
Good morning, Harry. Good morning, Jane Marie.
Good morning.
Good. What's on your mind this morning?
I'd like to revisit the topic you just talked about concerning the challenging of a will.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
The question is, if you question the mental capacity of the person that made the will, is that looked upon as a challenge to the will?
I think.
Yes, it is, because then you're questioning whether the will was.
Because you're trying to have the will
executed.
Thrown out, basically.
That's right.
If the person was mentally incompetent, well, it's not even that. The level of capacity required to sign a will is it's probably the lowest level of mental capacity there is. Mm-hmm. It's called testamentary capacity. And even people who are in the mid to late stages of dementia could still have testamentary capacity, even though medically the doctor might consider them to be incapacitated. So it's a gray area. But no, I think that it says, I'm sorry, if you contest my will, and you would contest the will on the basis of the fact that the person did not have the requisite mental capacity to mm-hmm. sign the will.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, and then what happens is, even if you were successful,
if you were successful in throwing out the will, then you're going to go to what you would get under intestacy.
Then you'd go intestacy unless there was a prior will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's a prior will, there's this concept mm-hmm. this concept called the doctrine of dependent relative revocation. And it's, well,
that's kind of heavy for a Saturday morning.
Today. It means if I sign my new will now, mm-hmm. it says in the first paragraph of the new will, I'm revoking all my prior wills.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm mentally incapacitated to make the new will, and the new will isn't valid, and somebody throws it out, then we would actually go back to a previous will,
mm-hmm. right.
not an intestacy immediately, unless there wasn't a previous will. And maybe you're in the previous will, and maybe you're not. Okay, I mean, mm-hmm. I was involved in a will contest about 20 years ago. It was very interesting. Where same thing here. A woman had three sons. She left one of her sons, the ne'er-do-well son. She left him, I think, $500,000, okay? And the other two sons got the rest of the estate, which was about $2 million each. Total estate was about $4.5 million. Well, of course, the son who got the $500,000 wasn't very happy. And his girlfriend was a lawyer in New York City, so they launched a will contest. They launched a will contest. Now, her will didn't have an interim clause in it. So they were not at risk of losing the $500,000. But what happened was about 6 or 8 months into the litigation, we discovered another will that this woman had made in Florida 10 years before the will that was in question. So guess what? The ne'er-do-well son in the prior Florida will got nothing. He didn't even get $500,000. He was mm-hmm. completely disinherited.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to the lawyer and say, okay, so guess what? If you win, you lose.
Right.
Okay, because if you don't take the $500,000, if you throw out the will and you win, you go back to the old will and you get nothing. So what do you want? We took the $500,000, we settled the case, and everybody went away. You know, I mean.
So would you advise if, as people continue to change or upgrade their wills, would you advise them to hold on to previous copies?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We never throw away a prior will. If we keep a will of a client in our vault, we keep the prior will. We do not have the client tear it up or shred it or destroy it in any way. We keep it just in case. Now, in the normal, you know, 99% of estates, everybody leaves everything to their kids in equal shares.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things we're finding in our law practice is increasingly people are starting to think about treating their children differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, I will see... classic example is a caretaker child.
Yes.
Daughter's mm-hmm. taking care of mom for the last 5 years. She's got two other kids. One of them lives locally, comes to see mom, you know, 3-4 times a year. The other one lives in California, maybe shows up once a year. Maybe mom comes in and says, hey, I think I'd like to leave 60% of my estate to my daughter and split the other 40% mm-hmm. between the other two kids. Well, I mean, it makes sense from a, you know, but it's going to create unhappiness, right?
Right. Another, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the kids are say, all right, you did all that work, but not usually. Usually they say it should be divided equally.
Right? You know, my response is, you know, depending on your family, can you sit down and talk about it? Okay. Mm-hmm. But invariably, you know, the other daughter might feel
left out.
Left out. And even if she doesn't, her husband might not be too mm-hmm. keen about it either. Mm-hmm. So it's a potential red flag. In those situations, I'm going to insist that we put one of those clauses in that says, hey, if you contest the will, mm-hmm. you don't get anything.
Okay.
Because
thank you for taking the time to answer the question.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thanks for listening,
Russell.
Have
a good weekend.
You too.
You too. Mm-hmm. Stay dry. Stay out of the snow. 476-5900 is our number here in the studio. If you are outside the local calling area, like Russell was, we had a 1-800-WROW-590.
So oftentimes, if someone is going to do a will where they're leaving things unequally, we take a little extra care to make sure that that's that person's intentions. Like we ask the family to leave the room. We talk to that person alone to make sure they're competent and they're not being influenced by anyone. So those are the things that you really want to take care of to make sure the will stands up later on.
Yeah, there are really only about two grounds to throw out a will. One is mental capacity. Mom hadn't the faintest idea what she was doing here, okay? I suppose in the Mary Lou Whitney estate, you could have... She made her will in 2017, about a year and a half before she died. She had had a series of strokes prior to that, and although she was pretty good, she had some side effects from that. And you could take a position that was an issue. The other grounds for throwing out a will are what are called fraud and undue influence. Mm-hmm. Okay, and particularly with a caregiver child, a dependent elderly parent not only becomes dependent on them physically but emotionally. They're emotional rock. So is that? I read a great article a couple of months ago, and it's called "Not All Influence Is Undue." Okay, so these are little hair-splitting things, you know. So the fact that you have influence over a parent does not necessarily mean that you have exercised undue influence. So
that's hard to.
And the problem with will contests is the only people who win are the lawyers.
Yes,
we earn substantial fees litigating a will contest. The client loses, all this money comes out of the estate. So I think upfront disclosure, transparency is always good, but a lot of people just are not emotionally or psychologically able to sit down with their kids and say, look, I'm leaving Sonny Boy more than you, and here's why, and if you don't like it, tough news.
Tough, that's right.
Tough.
That's right. And we'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, and Flatbush Road in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581, our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131, or our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. I'm Harry Miller.
And I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And Jane Marie, Jane Marie and I are with the Herzog Law Firm.
Harry, take two.
And thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
We'll have to re-record that spot.
Two first names confuses people.
It's true. It's true. But I'm listening at the intro, and the ad is reading off our offices. But we're going to have to re-record that one because we're opening a new office in Clifton Park this month.
Yes, that's right. We're happy to have a new office to service Clifton Park people who don't want to drive down in traffic, and I certainly don't blame them. Right. And we have an office there. We will be doing. We also have a new real estate attorney.
Dan Glasser.
That's right.
Yes.
And he will be doing real estate closings. He can mainly out of the Clifton Park office, but also Albany and Saratoga.
He's available in all offices.
All the offices.
He does a tremendous amount of single family real estate closings, purchases and sales. He also writes title. He's a title underwriter for a couple of different title companies. So. We've always done a fair amount of real estate closings because it's a throw off from the estate planning business. But now we'll be doing it on an even more full time basis.
Right. There's a large volume of that going on. Usually people buying and selling houses in trust or as a part of an estate. Mm-hmm. Right. But we'll just do other, regular real estate closings.
Yeah, regular closings. I mean, the market, I think, is still pretty active. I mean, mortgage rates are low. I think you can now get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for about 3.5%, I think, with no points.
Still very low.
I mean, so there's a lot of incentive out there to buy a house. You can buy a lot of house with a 3.5% mortgage. And, if you're in I mean, some of these apartments, like it's got on Wolf Road, they're $2,500 a month. I mean, you could probably borrow about, you know, $450,000 for a $2,500 a month mortgage payment. But George in Amsterdam is on the line. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing today?
Great, great. We're all getting ready for the snow.
Yeah, I know. My question is more of a clarification.
Sure.
We have all our things with your firm, including the trust. Now, if I remember correctly, income that's derived from an IRA can be attachable for Medicaid purposes, but not the principal of the IRA. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. IRAs have a special status. They're exempt for Medicaid purposes, but the income is not exempt. So if you are over, well, now 72, I suppose, and you're taking a required minimum distribution, that counts as income. Or if you're under 72 and you're applying for Medicaid, they force you to take a
distribution. You have to put it in distribution status, even though you're not 72. The new rules are, we're still sorting them out. In fact, this week I just did my first conduit trust where an IRA was the beneficiary of a trust. We're still using conduit trusts, but they have to be structured differently under the new SECURE Act in order to get the maximum benefit, because there are still some people who can do a stretch, very limited amount of people, but there are still some that can. But yeah, so if you got $100,000 in your IRA and your distribution this year was $7,000, the $7,000 is treated as part of your income. So they would divide it by 12, and that would be your monthly income from the IRA. But when you apply for Medicaid, the $100,000 in the IRA is disregarded as an asset. So you can keep it. And even if you're on Medicaid, when you die, it goes to your spouse or your children or whoever the beneficiary is. Okay? That isn't true of an annuity. If you have an annuity that is, and the person is on Medicaid, unless you have a spouse or a minor or disabled child, you've got to name the county social services department as the beneficiary of the annuity in order to have it disregarded as an asset that doesn't have to be spent down on Medicaid. So annuities can be used, but they only work in a context where there's a surviving spouse. I mean, it's rare that a person who's applying for nursing home Medicaid has a minor child. Although they may have a disabled child, they rarely would have minor children. So, you know, the rules for retirement is not just IRAs, but a 401k plan, a 403b, 457, all those things are just sections of the Internal Revenue Code that determine whether you work in the private sector, the educational sector, the nonprofit sector, or the state or municipality. So they all work.
So if somebody, but if somebody has a Medicaid trust and it was set up, you know, 6-7 years ago, then the SECURE Act has no effect on it.
No, because we're not. You can't put an IRA in a trust.
In the Medicaid trust.
You can't put it in a trust. You can make a trust the beneficiary of it.
Even if you don't have an IRA in the trust, let's say you just got a Medicaid trust for other things.
Correct.
Then the SECURE Act has no effect on it?
Absolutely not. Has no effect on the Medicaid trust, no.
Now my last question is, and then I'll be done.
That's all right.
Could you sort of give a brief overview of what assets are attachable for Medicaid purposes and what the spouse is allowed to keep and everything like that over the air? Or whatever, and then I'll just hang up, and I want to thank you for your time.
Oh, sure.
Thanks for listening. Thank you. Yeah, so when you're applying for Medicaid, there's very few things that are exempt. So we've already mentioned that the retirement accounts are exempt. Your home is exempt if your spouse is still living in the home, or a minor or a disabled child.
Right, and if it's worth less than $850,000.
That's right.
Isn't a big problem up here. If you get downstate into Westchester County, New York City, and Long Island,
oh, that could be a problem.
You know, $850,000 house isn't that great a house.
So other than those two large things that are exempt, they're going to count everything, you know, in the bank, your mutual funds, your stocks and investments. And if you're married, your spouse can keep up to $124,000. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get some protection. If you have more than that, then you're going to have to look at putting it into a trust, or the spouse can do a spousal refusal.
Right.
Which has pros and cons to it. So really the best plan is to, in advance, put your extra assets into a trust and do it 5 years before you need mm-hmm. planning, right? So people yeah. who are proactive are going to protect the most of their assets.
So I have, for instance, just by way of example, I have someone who came into my office within the last few weeks. We had set up a Medicaid asset protection trust for this person 15 years ago. And we put, they had two pieces of real estate, mm-hmm. and they put some of their stocks and bonds into the trust. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they didn't come back and re-review their estate plan for the last 15 years. Now the person is going or is in a nursing home. They still have almost $300,000 of assets that are not in their trust. And the person is widowed, all right, has no mm-hmm. spouse. So his resource allowance is about $15,000.
Right.
Now, if we simply spend down without doing anything, we're going to consume $300,000 in about a year and a half, all right? Mm-hmm. If we're looking at a nursing home, private pay, $15,000 a month, we're going to burn $180,000 a year, so that the $300,000 will be gone in 18 months. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that, we can implement for that person and for the family what's called a reverse rule of halves spend down plan, where effectively we can transfer assets and through a series of complicated steps that I won't bore you all with, we can basically save about half the money and get the person on Medicaid in 9 months instead of 18 months and save about $150,000 for the family. Okay, so it's not lost, but you're going to lose half of it.
That's right. But had you been proactive and done the trust 5 years
right.
or put the money in 5 years ago. Then
what we suggest is that you come back at least every 5 years and re-review your estate plan with us.
That's right.
And we look at things like, should we put some more money in the trust now because you're 5 years older,
right.
your health isn't as good as it was 5 years ago, and maybe I ought to dump another $100,000 into the trust and get the 5-year clock running on those assets.
So. Yeah, it's important to remember you don't have to put everything in all at once, and you can do it over time. So you may right. be thinking you're going to spend some of that money, but 5 years down the road, you realize you haven't spent as much as you thought you were going to.
Yeah.
So now you have some extra money you need to protect.
Yeah. I mean, another example, I had someone else in the last few weeks who's, oh, I'm okay. I got long-term care insurance. I said, great. Make sure you bring the policy in when you come in. Well, they have long-term care insurance. Yeah, they do. And guess what? It pays $200 a day. I said, well, that's great, but the nursing home charges $500
that's
a day.
Right.
So you're still going to pocket out the $300, and that's $9,000 a year. So you're going to still, even with the insurance, you're going to burn $100,000 a year. So why don't we look at a combination of insurance with the trust, and, right. and that way, in 5 years, we can get a lot of these assets protected.
Right.
So it works. The problem, long-term care, I mean, invariably with long-term care insurance, people... I just say 90% of clients have no idea what their long-term care policy covers.
True.
And so...
Well, actually, I thought you were going to say 90% of people don't have a policy.
Well, 90% of people don't have a policy, and the 10% that do have no idea what it covers. They say, oh, I've got nursing home insurance. I say, okay, that's great, but what does it cover? Oh, I don't know. I said, what's the daily rate? Oh, I don't know. You know, do we have a cost of living rider? I think so, but I'm not sure. So we got to bring in the policy. Call the agent, the people that sold you the policy. They will be able to explain to you what the policy.
Oftentimes, the company has changed many times since they bought it.
Yeah, they
it
all
too,
sold off so. Their. You know, a lot of these companies sold off their long-term care policies to other companies. But someone, I mean, the policies haven't gone away. They're still in effect, and they're very. They're complicated, as any insurance policy is complicated to read and understand.
But we can,
I don't care. It doesn't have to be long-term. You ever read your homeowner's policy? Your fire insurance policy?
Yeah.
It's incomprehensible.
It is.
I mean, you
it
go
is.
Through, oh, this is this. Well, this is covered, but then there's 27 exceptions in which it's not covered. I mean, come on,
Right. But we are used to reading long-term care policies, so we can look at those and help advise you about those.
Yeah. It's really important to do. 476-5900. We're rolling up here at about 29. And we'd love to talk to you. And next, we're going to talk to Steve in Red Hook. Morning, Steve.
Yes, good morning. I just got a curiosity question.
Sure.
If one spouse goes into a nursing home, can the other spouse file for divorce to protect their assets?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we have done that. However, It has to be a real divorce. It cannot be a sham divorce. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's called a Medicaid divorce.
Right.
We have done them in a situation. I've done them within the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. In that particular case, the couple had been separated for at least 5 years. They just hadn't officially gotten divorced. And so we had the wife divorced the husband. He was in a nursing home. And, you know, so once the divorce is finalized, then her assets are no longer considered as part of his Medicaid application. Now, if the couple simply gets divorced and simply continues to live together as if they were husband and wife, but they're no longer legally married, I'm sorry, but the Department of Social Services is going to consider that a sham divorce, and they're not going to recognize. They're going to consider themselves still married.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What, do you have some people watching them or something?
No, I had, I'll tell you, 20 years ago, I had, no, but they, well, for one thing, they have the same address, you know.
Oh.
You're going to have to give them the divorce decree. I had, 20 years ago, I had a couple who had, very new, they had actually gotten divorced. They were legally divorced, but they continued to occupy the same house together. Mm-hmm. Go figure. maybe it was cheaper, you know, maybe it was an economic relationship. I don't know. And we had a heck of a job with the county because they were, and we had to treat them essentially as two, you know.
As right together.
They treated them as a married couple, even though they weren't married.
Yeah. The other thing is just that spouse refusal. Is that acceptable in New York State?
Well,
it is acceptable.
Depends what county you live in.
True. It kind of goes by the county whether they decide to sue you afterwards. But there's still a benefit in filing a spousal refusal because if you get sued by the county is going to expect to recover from you what the county paid out for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And what the county is paying to the nursing home is about half of what you would pay privately. Mm-hmm. So when you have to pay back the county, you're paying them back at a lower rate than what you would pay privately for the nursing home. So you may not avoid having to pay the county anything, but if you do have to pay them, it's going to be a much lower amount.
Right. I mean, we do this for high net worth people. I mean, David always jokes about the fact that we could get Bill Gates on Medicaid, but in New York, we could. And we've done this for high net worth people where we have several million dollars involved and large incomes. And so the private pay bill is 15 grand a month. If we transfer all of the assets to the healthy spouse, it could be $3 million. Mm-hmm. And we apply for Medicaid for the institutionalized husband and we file a spousal refusal, he will be put on Medicaid. Now, the county attorney's office will immediately get in touch and demand and expect reimbursement. And of course we're going to reimburse them. But the Medicaid rate for that same bed is $8,000 a month instead of 15. So we've saved the family what, $85,000 a year.
Yep.
So there's a you know rich people can get on the Medicaid system. But we're paying the bill. We're not ripping off the system. But we're paying at a much reduced rate, as Jay Marie said. And now, it used to be a problem in the old days when we had a million-dollar estate tax threshold. You couldn't do it without possibly costing a huge amount in an estate tax bill. But now we've got a federal estate tax level that's almost $12 million, right, and a state level that's almost $6 million. Mm-hmm. And so even somebody with $4 million bucks can make these transfers without inadvertently triggering an estate tax down the road. So there are a lot of planning opportunities out there. It's just that, you know, most people don't know about them, but we can always help you with them.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend. 518-476-5900. We got about 10, 12 minutes left here in the hour. We'd love to hear your phone calls and chat with you this morning. We've been, we talked about community Medicaid. We talked about Mary Lou Whitney's estate. We were talking about all sorts of stuff.
So if you want to learn more about some of this stuff, you can come to one of our seminars next week. It's going to cover basic estate planning and Medicaid planning. And they will be Tuesday, January 21st at 2 o'clock at the Hampton Inn in Clifton Park. Wednesday, January 22nd at 2 o'clock at the Courtyard by Marriott on Washington Avenue. Thursday, January 23rd, we have two seminars. 1 in the morning at 10 o'clock at the new courtyard by Marriott on Wolf Road, and then in the afternoon at 2 o'clock at the courtyard by Marriott Mohawk Harbor in Schenectady over near Rivers Casino. And then not to forget our Kingston people on Thursday, January 30th at 2 o'clock at the Holiday Inn Express in Lake Katrine, New York.
Oh, yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Yep. Our next caller is Peggy. Peggy in Rensselaer County. Hey, Peggy.
Yes, I'm calling about my girlfriend. I have been trying to get her to make out a will.
Uh-huh.
Her husband has dementia.
Yep.
And she's got two children. They own their own home. And they have money, a little money in the bank and mm-hmm. property, but she refuses to make out a will. Mm. Now, what would happen to all her property?
Well, I suppose it depends how it's owned. But for instance, she has a house, I take it. If
yes.
her house is in joint names with her husband, then if she passed away before he did, the house would go to him. I mean, here's the deal. If she doesn't have a will, all of her jointly owned property would go to whoever the survived, probably her husband. And as you said, he has dementia. He might have to go to a nursing home if she's not around to take care of him. Now,
right.
all that property.
Would have to, yes.
So if unless one of the kids can take care of dad, all that property could be lost mm-hmm. to nursing home expenses. And rather than a good estate plan, might pass it on to the kids. Okay, who would take care of dad? Or there's a number of different things. One of her children could, you know, sit down and talk to her about it. Is she superstitious? Some people are superstitious about making a will.
Yeah. No, she just says, well, let them worry about it. And I said, you don't do that.
No, that's it's right. not a matter of worrying about it. It's just she's creating a potential mess for her family.
I am hearing a potential Medicaid risk if her husband goes mm-hmm. in the nursing home. She may lose assets, right? So she needs to think about protecting the assets.
Right.
Yeah, because we've done it. We've done our trust and everything. Yeah. And I told her, I said, you better do something. She's yes. going to doing that.
Well, if they have more than a house and $100,000, they have exposed assets. That mm-hmm. if he had to go into a nursing home next mm-hmm. week or next year, mm-hmm. Would have to be spent down in some fashion in order to do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can only do what you can do.
Yeah, I try to talk her into it, and she mm-hmm. just she refuses to mm-hmm. do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's too bad because, you know, in that case, maybe her kids could, you know, right. sit down and talk to her because it would be in everybody's best interest. I mean, the other problem is if she has to spend all these assets taking care of her husband in a nursing home, mm-hmm. she may not have enough money left to live on herself the rest of her life if she's in decent health or something like that. So
yeah, she is. But yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, something yeah. she just don't want to buy. She had to take care of her mother's mm-hmm. property
right.
when her mother died. Her mother had a will, and she did all that. And I said, well, now make yours. She goes, hey, I'll do it later. She never would do it.
She never will, yeah. No, well, you can't, you know, we
right.
encounter people like that. It's very frustrating for friends and family members like you. Who see the possibility of things going wrong, but, you know.
I mean, I hate to see, you know, fighting right. over the house, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. all her money in the bank and the property mm-hmm. and everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, if she died without a will, if she had assets that were just in her name alone and not in joint names with her husband, if a person who has a spouse and two children mm-hmm. dies without a will, the spouse effectively gets half the estate mm-hmm. and the other half goes to the children. Most people think, oh, if I don't have a will and I have $100,000 in a bank account, it's all going to go to my husband. No, it's not. Half of it's going to go to him and the other half is going to go to your kids. So again, the surviving spouse normally is going to need access to mm-hmm. those assets to
right.
continue to maintain their lifestyle. And,
right. Yeah.
yeah. So, you know.
Lots of good reasons for her to try and do some planning if, you know.
Yeah, and she's stubborn. I don't think she will.
They're always stubborn. Yes, they are.
Yep.
You can't tell them anything. I know.
Oh,
yep.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thanks for calling.
I got members of my own family that are stubborn like that.
that's right.
Although they did make wills, but they were stubborn about other things.
But you're right. Some people are superstitious about a will. I've heard clients say, if I sign my will, it means I'm going to die soon, right? I mean, you hear all kinds of weird superstitions. Right?
Well, eventually we're all going to die. You know, I was just saying, nobody gets out of here alive.
That's right. But you might as well take care of things, right? Have them go then, the way you want to.
And there's that old country and western song, you know? Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to go right now.
That's right.
All right, let's talk to Pat out in Delmar. Hi, Pat. Good morning.
Hi, Harry.
There you are.
Good morning, Harry.
Hello.
Question.
Okay.
The Secure Act.
Yes.
Tell us more about it, and is life insurance a good option to be looking at for the heirs now of 401, 403 under the new Secure Act?
Well, under the new Secure Act, two major things are happening. You can now accumulate your IRAs and 401ks until you're 72, all right? Rather than 70 and a half. However, if you're 70 and a half and you've already started taking distributions,
it's too late.
You're too late. You can't stop now and wait till you're 72. I'm in that box myself. I'm 70 and a half, but I'm not 72. So, but I had to start taking some distributions out of some of my IRAs, not all of them, because I'm still working. So those I can defer out, but there's some that I'm from other things. So you can't go back in retroactively. But if you're 68 or 69, you can let it ride tax deferred until you're 72. The other major change is a huge major change is it eliminates a stretch IRA for your children. Okay, the only people now who can do a stretch IRA are one, a surviving spouse, two, a disabled child, a minor child, a chronically ill person, and people who are no more than 10 years younger than you are, okay? Everybody else has got to take it out over 10 years, okay? And it's a real serious problem. I mean, let's say, for instance, we have an IRA that winds up in the hands of a 12-year-old kid.
A grandchild, so to speak.
A grandchild. So under the rule, the 12-year-old kid can use life expectancy to take out the IRA until they're 18, the age of majority. And then at 18, they got to cash it out over 10 years, between 18 and 28. Those are dangerous years for kids at that age to be receiving large chunks of money. So we're still looking at trust, but the kid's going to have to agree to the trust arrangement. It's can only tie it up so long. What else is happening in the Secure Act? I don't know. They're going to be starting to sell annuities to pension plans because you can do that under the new act. But those are the major changes, I think. And so you have to really, anyone who has set up any type of a conduit trust for receiving their IRA distributions as the trust as a beneficiary has got to have those re-reviewed.
Right, review them.
Because
amended, probably.
Some of them, I don't think accumulation trusts are going to work very well anymore. Conduit trusts still are, but they have to be revised to comply with the new Secure Act rules. Otherwise, if your trust isn't a conduit trust, then you're stuck with a 5-year payout because the 5-year payout rules for estates and non-conduit, non-see-through trusts haven't gone away. They're still there. So you could, if you don't do the right kind of structuring and if you don't have people who understand how to set up a see-through trust, you could have to take it out over 5 years instead of 10 years, which would be even worse. So, you know.
But that changes everything, yes. That changes a lot, Harry.
Yes.
It changes a lot for planning.
What about protecting some of those assets? Is it better off to be looking at somehow moving over towards life insurance or other methods?
I don't know. I think what's going to happen is the insurance, the annuity industry is going to come up with a whole bunch of new products to sell life insurance to you to cover the tax liabilities. I'm sure there'll be different products that will shelter some of the tax aspects. It's just this law only went into effect, about 18 days ago. And so none of that stuff is, if it's coming out, it hasn't been widely advertised anymore. So I'm sure there are going to be ways to alleviate the tax impact of it. But, you know, I'm looking at people who have substantial IRAs, who have $1 million or $2 million in an IRA, and all of a sudden the beneficiary has to cash it out over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to push them into a very high income tax bracket. But the the government has decided they're going to force you to collapse these things. They want to collect the tax in 10 years instead of 15 or 20 years. And the other thing is, this all not only applies to regular IRAs, it applies to Roths. So when you inherit a Roth IRA from your parent, even though it's non-taxable, you're still going to have to cash it out over 10 years. Okay, under the theory that the government wants to force the collapse and liquidation of this non-taxable asset, under the theory that you will take the money and purchase assets that are taxable, so they'll be able to start collecting tax on the money again in a shorter period of time. The uncle is always looking for ways to get into your pocket.
Well stated.
Well, thank you for the question. Sure, there's going to be a lot of planning coming up around.
There are, and we're probably going to be talking more on the radio. We may wind up in the spring, or certainly at our annual client event, which is usually in June, May or June.
Right.
We're going to be talking a lot about the Secure Act, and I think we'll have some more things come out when these new laws come out. It takes a while for everybody to get used to them and accustomed to it, but this affects almost everybody. I mean, almost everybody has some kind of an IRA or a 401k.
That has their children.
It has their children, and we're going to have to look at those issues.
Thanks for hanging out with us. Talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
590 on your radio, AlbanyMagic.com on your digital devices, and 100.5 FM. WENU, W245DX, Southlands Falls.
590 and 100.5, the capital city.
It's 9 o'clock.
CBS News Update. Winter has much of the country in its grip this weekend, with blizzard warnings, whiteout conditions, and dangerous travel. CBS News meteorologist Jeff Birardelli.
There are winter weather alerts for 26 states right now, coast to coast. But the worst of it is going to be in the Midwest, Great Lakes, and Northeast. The bigger cities, so places like Pittsburgh and places like Cleveland and places like New York City and Boston, likely to see about 2 to 4 inches of snow. And then in many cases, there will be a changeover to ice and eventually to rain.
The Dakotas got belted. First grade teacher Jordan Osterberg is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
It's really icy, too. I know I've seen some people get stuck, so it's pretty crazy over here.
A sentiment from Angela Shaw that was likely echoed by millions in the Plain States and upper Midwest.
We'll just stay in the house and, you know, do some things around here, and hopefully once it's over, then, you know, dig our way out Sunday morning.
CBS News Update, I'm Bud Mishkin.
All the latest news on the hour on Magic 590 and 100.5.
It's a minute past 9 o'clock. Time now for a Saturday traffic alert. We have a crash on I-87 Northway northbound before the Twin Bridges in the town of Half Moon. So you're going to want to stay over to the left as the right shoulder is closed right now. Again, right shoulder closed, I-87 Northway northbound, just before the Twin Bridges. Be careful in that area, I-87 northbound. That is a look at your Saturday morning traffic.
Capital City weather.
Now for Magic 590 and 100.5, here's your CBS 6 Weather Authority forecast. Snow starts this afternoon, could be moderate to heavy at times at a high of 28 degrees. Snow tapers off to snow showers overnight tonight, low 27. Tomorrow we'll see some breaks of sun, windy, turning colder. Scattered snow showers and a high of 35 degrees. That'll be towards midday, and then temperatures will drop into the 20s during the afternoon. Monday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, mostly sunny and cold, high 23. Albany temperature, 11 degrees above zero. Glens Falls and Lake George both at 7. Ride to work mornings with the Jay and Ben Show and drive home afternoons with Bob Johnson on the Capital Region's oldie station, Magic 590 and 100.5.
590 and 100.5.
Information presented on this program is believed to be factual and up to date, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, and it should not be regarded as a complete analysis of subjects discussed. Discussions and answers to the questions do not involve the rendering of personalized investment advice, but are limited to the dissemination of general information and may not be suitable for members of the listening audience. A professional advisor should be consulted before implementing any of the strategies presented. Some of the products and concepts discussed during the show have their own costs and are subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. These costs and risks will be thoroughly discussed with you prior to any recommendation or solicitation.
Now from Magic 590 and 100.5, the Retirement Planning Show with Dave Kopeck. Dave's offices are located at 60 Railroad Place, Suite 100, Saratoga Springs, New York. 125 Wolf Road, Suite 122, Albany, New York, 12205. And 238 Bay Road, Queensbury, New York, 12804. Dave Kopeck is a registered representative offering securities through Securities Service Network, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC, and an investment advisor representative offering advisory services through SSN Advisory, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Now, the Retirement Planning Show on Magic 590 and 100.5.